Welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast that is absolutely, completely, totally committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today will be no exception. I absolutely promise you that. If you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe, rate, review. It helps a lot. My guest today is an amazing human being. He's been a friend of mine for a long time. I'm going to introduce him in just a few moments, but I want to set the stage by talking a little bit about the subject at hand. And perhaps I should start by saying that the people of Palestine are caught in the crosshairs of the only significant religious system in the history of the human race, with a geopolitical structure, a structure of laws that mandate violence against the infidel. And while so much has been made about the state of Israel and several stages and shades of Zionism, stages that play a role in the complicated history of Zionism, it is impossible to accurately assess the Israeli-Palestinian conflict if you don't understand the most important factor of them all. And that factor is Islam, a factor that my guest, as you'll see, knows a great deal about. And for all the debate about Islam, about the growing presence of Islam in the world, there's one thing that is so often overlooked. And I've said this in various forms. I've written about this. And that is the fact that Islam is not a religion in the sanitized Western sense. It's an all-encompassing socio-political legal matrix. A legal matrix that has bred a worldview antagonistic to anything but itself. And while, and I've said this many times, there might be millions of peaceful and tolerant Muslims, many of them are neighbors, Islam itself is hardly peaceful and hardly tolerant. Now, there are people of other faiths, like Christians, that live in the land called Palestine. In fact, I have close personal friends among them. The majority of the people occupying that territory, however, are Muslims. And all of the citizens are led by Hamas. Hamas being a militant Islamic organization, an organization with connections throughout the Islamic world that undoubtedly and unabashedly desire the destruction of all Jews. And not only that, but the death of America itself, ultimately the death of the West. And I don't think that can be overstated. And any intentions of a peaceful resolution to this conflict in the Middle East are in direct contradiction with the ideology of Islam, most notably jihad against the infidels. The conflict in the Middle East might actually end up playing a pretty decisive role in who becomes president of the United States of America. So what we're talking about is not tangential, it's not insignificant, it's at the epicenter of what's going on in the world. Right now, the Democratic Party is doing a dance with the devil to satisfy an increasingly hostile group of protesters who are uncritically characterizing anyone who sides with Israel. Well, how they characterize them? As accomplices to genocide. And it's striking to see pro-Palestinian protests that are erupting across the U.S. Maybe I should say, not surprising, because you only have to look at the self-stultifying support of the group Queers for Palestine as evidence that the protesters often have little understanding of the ideologies at play when it comes to this particular conflict. And that, unfortunately, is par for the course concerning a civilization that seeks to cut off or saw off the branch upon which it sits at every opportunity. And tragically, eventually, that civilization, I'm talking about Western civilization, will fall. The peace process, or the lack thereof, within Palestine points to a far greater problem, however. Islamic immigration internationally, and the millions of Muslims who have no intention whatsoever of assimilating into Western culture. What role does immigration play in all of this? Well, perhaps the greatest role of all. All you need to do is look at the unmitigated disaster occurring in European countries, countries like France and Germany and the United Kingdom. And when you look at those countries, you understand the dangers of migration without assimilation. It's often been called, I don't know who said this, but I love the phrase, it's the python swallowing its prey with a long and slow digestion. I also think of something I wrote about in my book, Muslim, the words of the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, who said, we don't need to fly planes into buildings because with time, those buildings are going to belong to us. And he was alluding to his understanding that the migration and growth of Muslim populations in the West would eventually lead to significant influence and control over Western societies, period. Almost 15 years after his death, maybe it's a little more now, I can't remember, I feel pretty confident in saying that he would be shocked at the success of his own purported strategies, especially when it comes to the increasingly self-loathing state of Western societies, and we're in a bad state. Most shocking of all of this is Western elites who happen to be more concerned with censoring their citizenry than taking an honest assessment or examination of Islam in line with the illiberal liberalism invoked in the face of impending accusations of, and here's the key word, Islamophobia. You know, the minute you start talking like this, and my guest knows this better than anybody else, that label is attached to your name. So make no mistake, in a time of a civilizational crisis, Islam is at the heart of this clash of civilizations. And in times like these, in times where honest information is in short supply, it's imperative that we learn to lean on the counsel of experts if we're going to pursue discernment. And the key is discernment. This is why I've invited one of the world's leading experts on Islam to discuss what he deems to be, and this is the title of his book, The Palestinian Delusion. His name is Robert Spencer. He is a friend. He is director of Jihad Watch. He's a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. And his list of accomplishments and his importance to our society cannot be overstated. He has led seminars on Islam and jihad for the FBI, for the United States Central Command, for the United States Army Command, for the General Staff College, the U.S. Army's Asymmetric Warfare Group, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, the Justice Department's Anti-Terrorism Advisory Council, the U.S. Intelligence Community. He has discussed jihad, Islam, and terrorism at a workshop sponsored by the U.S. State Department and the German Foreign Ministry, and he's a consultant with the Center for Security Policy. Robert Spencer is the author of more than 20 books. He's an incredible writer. He's got an incredible mind. And included in those books is a New York Times bestseller titled The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam. It's one of the first books that I ever read by Robert Spencer. And by the way, it is properly titled The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam, and in parentheses, and the Crusades. He's also written a book called The History of Jihad from Muhammad to ISIS. And, you know, one of the great privileges I had personally is he wrote the foreword to my book, Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. He has been my guest on many occasions on the Bible Answer Man broadcast and the Hank Unplugged podcast. I haven't had him on the podcast for a long time, so it's long overdue. Robert Spencer, I am just delighted to have you back in the Hank Unplugged podcast studios.
It's very good to see you again, Hank. Thank you.
And you look absolutely amazing. You've got a beautiful blue. I mean, we're doing this on video as well as audio, but if you're only listening on audio, he's got a beautiful blue suit on and a red tie and just looks as amazing as ever. Robert,
I'm celebrating that I can tie a tie again because I broke my hand in June and couldn't do it for a few months. And so I was just able to tie a tie again now. So now I do it every time I can.
I don't know of anyone who has received more flack in the 21st century than you have. I mean, you are a guy that is willing to take the hits.
Yes, no doubt about that.
Talk about that a little bit. I mean, the controversy and the things that you have gone through to try to get your message across. One of the most important, we could say controversial, but it's a very important message.
I'll tell you, Hank, though, you said it in the prologue there that the label Islamophobia gets attached to you as soon as you go into the motivating ideology of jihad terrorism. And that started very early on. Actually, I was doing this before they had invented the word Islamophobia. So I was called a hate monger for speaking about the contents of the Quran and the contents of the teachings of Muhammad. And I always thought that was kind of ironic because they didn't say that Muhammad's teachings or the Quran were hateful, but I was just hateful for quoting them. And it's unfortunately, the Quran says what it says, no matter what I do. But there has been a tremendous societal stigma placed upon speaking honestly about Islam. The whole idea of Islamophobia is to intimidate people into thinking that there's something wrong or bigoted or hateful about opposing jihad terror. And so you even have, nowadays we have elected officials, if they say the slightest critical thing about Islam or even about jihadis, they end up having to apologize, they end up resigning in disgrace, and it's considered to be something you just don't do. You don't ever say anything negative or critical regarding Islam. Now, I've striven all through all the books that I've written and everything that I've done to be scrupulously accurate, and that is why I've been able to stand up to all this, all these charges, because I know that what I'm saying is true. And it's if anybody who reads the Quran, anybody who studies the life of Muhammad, anybody who looks at jihad activity around the world, they're going to see that it's true. And so I'm sorry that it's unpopular nowadays to say. But, well, as a very famous man once said, here I stand, I can do no other.
Yeah. You mentioned the Quran, Robert, and I'm wondering if it's fair to say that when you talk about the Quran, you're really, in essence, talking about two books rather than one. There's a book that seems to be very peaceful and loving and kind when Muhammad was an itinerant prophet in Mecca. And there's a book that is very warlike and acerbic and dangerous. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, to some degree. I wouldn't go all the way to say that the first book, as you put it, is loving. It's not in the least loving. It is relatively peaceful. But I'll give you an example. What you're talking about is the distinction between the Meccan surahs. A surah is a chapter of the Quran, and there are 114 chapters, and they're divided into surahs that were revealed to Muhammad supposedly in Mecca during the first 12 years of his career as a prophet, or those that were revealed to him in Medina in the second 10 years of his career as a prophet, which comprised 23 years altogether. So we're talking 12 years give and take, and 10 years give and take. And actually, in another book, Muhammad, A Critical Biography, I show that even the chronology is disputed, but that's the most widely accepted version. 12 years in Mecca and 10, 10 and a half in Medina, although he returned to Mecca toward the end. Anyway, the Meccan passages, the earlier revealed ones, generally do not call for warfare, but they are not loving. For example, you have chapter 109 of the Quran, which says, "Say to the unbelievers, I do not worship what you worship, and you do not worship what I worship. I'm not going to worship what you worship, and you are not going to worship what I worship. To you, your religion, and to me, mine." Now, that's not actually a very loving statement. There's no statement of respect or regard, much less love for the unbelievers. But there is a recognition that the unbelievers do not worship Allah and are not going to, and that likewise, Muhammad and the Muslims do not worship what the unbelievers worship, and they're not going to. And so he says, essentially, let's leave each other alone. The Meccan passages enjoin what is generally, I think, accurately stated as tolerance, that let's leave each other alone and each can practice his religion as he sees fit. But then when he moved to Medina, he became for the first time the head of state and the head of an army. And that led to the revelation, according to Islamic tradition, of passages that call for warfare, first defensive warfare, but also offensive warfare. For example, chapter 8, verse 39, which says, "Fight them until persecution is no more and religion is all for Allah." Now, if I'm going to fight you, if you're persecuting me, then you have obviously started it and I'm defending myself. But if I must continue the fighting until your religion is for Allah, then you might be minding your own business and going about the various details of your life, and then I have to come and fight you. So that's an offensive warfare and an open-ended declaration of war against the non-Muslim community, the entire non-Muslim world. And so throughout the history of Islam, we see warfare against unbelievers being pursued because Islamic theologians from the beginning have taught that what comes chronologically later, if there's any contradiction or disagreement between those passages and what comes earlier, the later passages supersede the earlier. And that principle is also in the Quran itself, in chapter 2, verse 106. When we abrogate a passage or cause it to be forgotten, we will give you one that is just as good or better. So if it's considered to come later in Muhammad's life, then it takes precedence. Unfortunately, the violent passages come later in Muhammad's life and thus take precedence. So standard mainstream Islamic theology across the sects, across the schools of jurisprudence, teach that warfare against unbelievers is something that the Islamic community is obliged to pursue whenever and wherever it can.
Brilliant answer. I want you to start the embryonic stages of this podcast by talking about a chant that we're hearing all the time on our television screens, on radios. We see on the internet, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." What does that really entail?
Well, the river in question is the Jordan River, and the Mediterranean Sea is the sea, and that's where Israel is, between the river and the sea. So what they're saying is, we want to see Israel destroyed and a 23rd Arab state established. And so the idea is that not just that Israel will be destroyed, but you're talking about 7 million Jews and 2 million Arabs who live in Israel today. Where are they going to go? The Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and the leaders of Hamas have both stated repeatedly that they're not going to allow a single Jew to live in the Arab Muslim state that they want to establish. And so consequently, we're talking about what is likely to be a new genocide of the Jews, millions of people killed in order to establish a Palestinian state from the river to the sea. It is a frankly genocidal call that very few people recognize as such.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you that, Robert. When people mouth these slogans, do they really know what they're talking about?
Well, you know, there are a lot of men on the street interviews around these days that are ludicrous because they show that these people have no idea what they're talking about. the guy with the microphone goes up and says, okay, which river and which sea are you talking about? And they don't have any idea. And so it's very clear that these people are indoctrinated, they're propagandized, but they don't know the history of the region. They don't know the legal claim that Israel has to the land. And so they're just being manipulated.
Talk about how important, you just mentioned a region, how important the Levant is. I've often said that this is the geographical center of the Middle East. It's the crossroads of human history. It's a land bridge linking three continents, Europe, Asia, and Africa. But that only tells part of the story.
Well, so much, really. For one thing, I think that one of the reasons why there's so much conflict right now is because it is the area in which Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all originated. Now, Islam is supposed to have originated in Arabia, a little farther to the south. I tend to favor the historical investigations of more recent period that indicate that it actually did originate closer to Jerusalem, closer to the area of the Levant in general than is ordinarily recognized. But in any case, quite aside from that, Islam claims Jerusalem as the third holiest city in Islam. It is, of course, the city in which the Lord Jesus lived and preached and so on, and died and rose from the dead. And of course, it is the city of the Jews from time immemorial, going back 3,000 years, more than that. And in the Jewish prayers for Passover, you have the statement next year in Jerusalem that Jews all over the world have said, century after century, focusing on one day returning to their homeland. And so this makes for, in itself, a kind of an explosive situation where Islam claims the land. Christianity doesn't claim the land, but wants to have a presence there. And of course, the Jews have reclaimed the land as their homeland since 1948, creating a great deal of friction with the Muslims in the area. So it's kind of a tinderbox. At the same time, it is indeed quite literally a crossroads, because you've got Europe very close by on one side and the Middle East very close by on the other. And it's sort of at the fault line between the Western world and the Islamic world. And so that also creates tensions and difficulties. It's interesting that it's a relatively inhospitable piece of territory with value in an objective sense that isn't very high in terms of land that can be cultivated or land that is attractive or appealing to live on. But it's nonetheless, probably, I think, without any exaggeration, the most hotly contested piece of real estate on earth because of its religious significance for all three religions, its cultural significance, and of course, its location.
Yeah, so I remember speaking at the University of Tehran in Iran in 2012, and I heard over and over again when I was in Iran, the three Abrahamic religions, you know, peaceful coexistence between the three Abrahamic religions. But if you understand Islam like you understand Islam, I think you have to, in all fairness, say that Islam is at its core anti-Semitic and anti-Christian. Is that a fair statement?
Couldn't agree more. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you hear this talk about Abrahamic religions, but really, I think the key to understanding what that really means, for particularly for Muslims, is to look at chapter 3, verse 67 of the Quran, where it says that the Jews and Christians argue about Abraham, but Abraham was neither a Jew nor Christian. Abraham was a Muslim. And people laugh, you know, when I'm out speaking sometimes and I quote that, people think it's ludicrous, because how could Abraham be a Muslim when he's before Muhammad and Muhammad is the originator of Islam? But you have to understand that Islam teaches that all the biblical prophets, and Jesus as well, were Muslims who taught Islam, and that it was their followers who twisted their teachings to create Judaism and Christianity as we know them. And so, as a result, you have no legitimacy to Judaism and Christianity at all. They are twisted and hijacked versions of the original Islamic faith. That's the Muslim view. And consequently, when people talk about the three Abrahamic religions, that might be how ecumenists among Jews and Christians think, but that's not how Muslims generally think of it. They think of Islam as the Abrahamic religion and the other two as illegitimate renegade versions of the Abrahamic religion.
It's so interesting when you read Galatians. Galatians tells us that Abraham only had one seed, and that seed is Jesus Christ. And then the double entendre at the end of Galatians chapter 3 is that if you are in Jesus Christ, you are the seed of Abraham, whether you're Jew or Gentile, whether you're slave or free, whether you're rich or poor. It doesn't have anything to do with your station in life. It doesn't have anything to do with your gender. It doesn't have anything to do with your nationality. If you are in Christ, you are Abraham's seed and an heir according to the promise. At any rate, talk about the end times in Muslim lore. A lot of people in the Christian community are talking about the end of the world. Dispensationalists, which is a broad swath of Christianity, are talking about the fact that the rapture is going to happen, we're going to get out of here, and then two-thirds of the Jews are going to die in a bloody Holocaust, exceeding anything that's ever happened to them in their history. But in Muslim lore, there's also a perspective on the end times, and I don't think people are familiar with their perspective.
It's very illuminating, as a matter of fact, and I think if more Christians were aware of this, they wouldn't be so sanguine and be mouthing all these platitudes about Abrahamic religions. For one thing, there is a hadith in which Muhammad is quoted as saying that there will be no one more repugnant in the sight of Allah on the day of judgment than he who calls himself the King of Kings. It seems to me that's very clear that what the Islamic eschatology is setting up is that Jesus is the villainous figure. That is the Jesus of Christianity on the Day of Judgment. And so it's just the opposite of the Christian view of the end times. You take also, for example, a better known hadith in which Muhammad says that at the last day, Jesus will return, will break the cross, kill the pig, and abolish the jizya. Now, this is Jesus, the Muslim prophet, and he's going to come back to earth at the end of the world. It's interesting to note that he comes back, not Muhammad. And that's just one of many indications that Jesus is more than what Islam makes of him, and that Islamic theology regarding Jesus doesn't really make sense on its face. It's a half-baked reinterpretation and adaptation of Christian theology that doesn't hang together of itself. But anyway, Jesus will come back, break the cross, kill the pig, and abolish the jizya. He will break the cross because, of course, the Quran says in chapter 4, verse 171, they did not kill or crucify him, but it appeared so to them. They thought they were crucifying Jesus. This is the Jews, of course, but they were not actually doing so. And the cross, according to Islamic theologians and apologists to this day, the cross is an insult. The cross is an affront. It's a challenge to the power of Allah, that Allah would not allow one of his prophets to suffer the humiliation and the indignity of being killed on the cross. And so Jesus did not die on the cross. This is an insult to say about Jesus. So when Jesus, the Muslim prophet, returns, the first thing he will do is break the cross. Presumably, that will mean the destruction of all the churches, the destruction of Christianity as we know it, because the churches have crosses in them, and they preach Christ crucified, or at least they ought to. And so, well, you know, that's a whole other discussion. But anyway, that means that Christianity is destroyed at the hands of Jesus himself. He will kill the pig because the Christians eat pork, because they don't obey the food laws that are mandated in the Torah and also in Islam. And so it's the Christians who are ignoring the food laws that Allah has given, and that will be ended. Jesus will make it end by killing all the pigs so the Christians can't eat them anymore. And he will abolish the jizya. The jizya is the tax that is specified, chapter 9, verse 29 of the Quran, that the Muslims should fight even against the people of the book, who are mainly Jews and Christians, until they pay the jizya, which is a tax, with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. The tax is an allowance that makes it possible for Jews and Christians to live in the Islamic society without becoming Muslims. They're free to remain Jews and Christians, but they have to accept a second-class inferior status, all manner of institutionalized discrimination, and they have to pay this special tax that the Muslims don't have to pay. And that's something that's been collected in Islamic societies throughout history. But Jesus will come back, he'll put an end to that. And that means there will be no more demitude, there will be no more of this enforced second-class status for the Christians and the Jews, and they'll be allowed to remain in their religions. At that point, the Christians will have to either become Muslim or be killed by Jesus himself. So Jesus himself is envisioned as destroying Christianity at the end of the world. This is an eschatology very few people, very few Christians today are aware of, and certainly even fewer have pondered its implications for interreligious dialogue and cooperation with Muslims.
So a lot of people listening in might be thinking that's fringe Islam you're talking about. But what you're saying is, no, it's not fringe, it's mainstream.
Oh, that's quite right. Yeah. The hadiths that I quoted about nobody being more repugnant in the sight of Allah on the day of judgment than the King of Kings, and Jesus will come back and break the cross, kill the pig, and abolish the jizya, those are both in the hadith collections that are considered most reliable by Islamic scholars. There's six hadith collections that are called the Sahih Sittah, that is, the reliable collections that are generally considered to be trustworthy, and when it comes to matters of Islamic law, normative for that law. And the most trustworthy of those are those of the Imams Bukhari and Muslim, and these stories appear in those. And so you would be hard-pressed to find a Muslim who would say, no, these are fake and inauthentic, if he was being honest.
I got to tell you a little story here and get your reaction to the story. I oftentimes say that there are many, many peace-loving Muslims, but Islam is not a religion of peace. And sometimes I get some pushback on that, but the story involves when I was in Tehran. I remember the first day I was in Tehran, I went to my hotel in the epicenter of the city, and I never came out of my room because I was pretty intimidated. And the next morning, my interpreter was a woman named Fatima, and she said to me, how was your evening? And I said, well, I didn't really go anywhere. I just stayed in my room. And she said, why? And I said to her, quite honestly, well, I was kind of intimidated. And she said to me, Hank, you can walk the streets of Tehran in the middle of the night, no one will harm you. And Robert, I can tell you I did that. And people were kind and generous. They made change for me because I was, you know, you couldn't use your cell phone, you couldn't use your computer, you couldn't use credit cards, you know. So, you know, I had the currency that I'm familiar with, and people had to make change for me and all that. Talk about that very notion. I mean, the Persians are very hospitable people. I found them to be gracious and loving and kind. I mean, we had a different, even in the University of Tehran, Alameh Tebetibar spoke there as well. I was treated with dignity and respect by the students. Where's the disjuncture there?
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of things that are going on there. One of them is that one of the glories, one of the real positive aspects of both Persian culture and Arab culture, you could say of the cultures in that part of the world in general, is a very strong emphasis on hospitality and welcoming the stranger. This is something I think that we've kind of forgotten about in the West, maybe because our own societies, you know, you couldn't say that in any American city, Hank, you can walk around at night and nobody's going to harm you. I have to go to New York in a few weeks, and I'm not looking forward to it, even in the middle of the day. And I wouldn't hesitate, were I to go to Tehran, to walk around. I might not go because I would be afraid that having criticized Muhammad, I might end up in prison. But I certainly wouldn't be afraid of street thuggery or crime. And the hospitality toward the stranger, that is a very strong cultural tendency, that's one thing. Another is also, it should be noted that that is also reinforced in the Quran itself. Even in chapter 9, which is the most fierce chapter that calls for warfare against unbelievers, it says at the beginning of the chapter that you should welcome these people and give them a chance to convert and let them stay around for a while. And so this can lead also to hospitality and kindness on a personal level. When we talk about the doctrines of Islam, we're talking about the doctrines of Islam. We are not talking about what any given person believes or acts upon. Also, these doctrines, it should be noted that even if they do teach that Christianity is an illegitimate false religion and a twisting of Jesus's actual words, that doesn't mean that the Quran ever says to be mean and nasty and rude to Christians. It says to work to convert people, and it certainly says to subjugate them and hold political hegemony over them in an ideal Islamic society. But this is not the same as being nasty to them. On the other side, you do have the hadith where Muhammad says, when you see the Jews and Christians, force them to the narrowest part of the road. And it was part of the Dhimmi laws up to through the 19th century, through the middle of the 19th century, that if you were walking down a sidewalk and you saw a Muslim coming and you were non-Muslim, you had to get off and let him pass. And so there was a certain hierarchy embedded in the society. But nonetheless, these things don't necessarily mean that everybody is going to be treating you terribly at all times. The theology is one thing and human behavior is another. Every individual Muslim has a variety of perspectives and priorities and influences. And so also, whatever Islam may teach, he's going to be kind to you or unkind to you based on what is going on in his own life. Also, it must be noted that in Iran, there's a great falling away from Islam because people have lived under the Islamic Republic since 1979 and they have had their fill of it. If Iran is officially 99% Muslim, but there was a survey just a year or so ago that showed that only 40% of Iranians today will still identify as Muslim. And I'm not saying in the slightest degree that this is why they were nice to you or that there's any connection necessarily at all, but just to say that it's extremely unlikely that you encountered anyone who had any of the teachings of Islam that we are discussing today on this program in his mind when he had you face to face and thinking, this is a Christian, so I have to treat him in some disrespectful way or something of that nature.
Yeah. I want to get right to one of the similar issues that you deal with in your book, and that is the issue of a two-state solution. And I suppose the most obvious question I can ask you, is there any real possibility for a two-state solution in the Middle East?
There's a possibility for two states, but it's not a solution. That is, we could end up with a Palestinian state. Everybody wants one. Even the Israelis have said, although they've retreated from this since October 7th, and so it depends on how much they can be forced, but the European Union wants a Palestinian state, the United Nations wants a Palestinian state, many of the countries of the world already recognize a Palestinian state, even though one does not actually exist. The United States State Department and the Biden administration, they want a Palestinian state. Everybody in the world wants a Palestinian state, except the Palestinians. They have rejected offers for a state on numerous occasions, starting in 1947. Actually, there was an earlier offer from the British in the 30s that they rejected, and then the United Nations partitioned the territory that was the mandate for Palestine for the establishment of a Jewish national home, and they partitioned that to create a 23rd Arab state and a single Jewish state, and the Arabs said no. And then the Israelis offered it to them again after 1967, and they said no. The Oslo Accords in the 1990s were designed to establish the framework for the establishment of a Palestinian state. And that's why we have the Palestinian Authority today. But it was Ehud Barak, the Prime Minister of Israel, made a very generous offer in the year 2000, I believe it was, of meeting 98% of the demands of the Palestinians for various territories and offering them compensatory territory that was part of Israel for the other 2%. so that they ended up with more than what they asked for, and they said no. Ehud Olmert, another prime minister of Israel, renewed the offer in 2007, was likewise rejected. Why did the Palestinians always reject a state? Because the condition was that they had to accept there being a Jewish state next door. And they would never accept that because of the Islamic imperative embedded in the Quran in chapter 2, verse 191. Very simply, Hank, drive them out from where they drove you out. This was Muslim land under the Ottomans and under the Arabs before that. And so they believed that any land that was Muslim land at any time belongs by right to the Muslims forever because the Quran says, drive them out from where they drove you out. If a land was Muslim and is no longer, then the Muslims have the responsibility before Allah, a divine command, to drive out those who displaced them and reestablish the hegemony of Islam in the land. So the Palestinians could never accept a Jewish state. Nowadays, it may be that for tactical reasons, they will agree. But even if they do agree, and a Palestinian state is established and Israel still exists, and even if the Palestinian leaders pay lip service to accepting the existence of Israel, they will continue to make war on Israel and continue to try to destroy it until they succeed. There's no way they can stop doing that because it's a Quranic imperative.
Tell me a little bit about the Palestinian flag. I've been watching television because of the conventions and so forth. And when I watch television, I see so many people draped in Palestinian flags. And I oftentimes, upon looking at them, I wonder to myself, do they have any idea of the history of that flag and really how recent that history is?
Yeah, I think they probably don't. They probably think this is the flag of the old state of Palestine that was displaced by the Israelis when the Israelis stole the land. This is ahistorical fiction. There was never a Palestinian state. And so there was no Palestinian flag because there was no Palestinian people. If you go back before 1964, there was plenty of controversy. Hank, there was extraordinary controversy and often armed conflict between the Zionists and the Arabs who were there in the area. And they had the partition that I was just talking about that the UN tried to effect in 1947. And so much discussion about this issue, and nobody ever mentions the Palestinians. It's extraordinary because the Palestinians are on the tip of everyone's tongue today. But you find zero, absolutely no mention of the Palestinian people before 1964. They were invented in 1964 as a rhetorical weapon to beat the Israelis with, and it's been a remarkably successful invention. They are actually Levantine Arabs who are no different culturally, linguistically, or religiously from the Arabs of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. And they've never been ethnically distinct, never been a nationality or an ethnicity at all. So they never had a flag. It was a British colonel, Colonel Sykes, who was responsible for the Sykes-Picot Agreement that actually Islamic supremacists and jihadis tend to hate because it was drawing borders in the Middle East in the area that they thought of should be the United Ummah, the United Islamic Community. Colonel Sykes developed that flag as a flag for one of the Arab kingdoms that the British were setting up in some of the land that they controlled after World War I in the Middle East. And so it's not even originally the Palestinian flag. It was invented by a British man, and it was originally the flag of a defunct Arab kingdom. And then in the 60s, when the Palestinian nationality was invented, it wasn't being used, and it was appropriated by the Palestine Liberation Organization, which renamed itself the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Very important distinction, a hardly noticeable distinction. In fact, it was not at all noticed at the time that the change was made. But there was always the land of Palestine. The Romans renamed the land of Judea, which means land of the Jews, Palestine, to taunt the Jews in the year 134 AD. And they chose that word out of the Bible as the name the Philistines, the name of the ancient enemies of the Israelites, who had long since died out. There's no connection between the Philistines and the Palestinians or Palestine. But anyway, they called the place Palestine. They called Judea Palestine. But it was always the name of a region. It was never the name of a people. It's like Staten Island. Staten Island is a real place, and there are people who live there, but they don't have a special ethnicity or nationality. There's not a Staten Islandish people. They're just New Yorkers or whatever they may be. And so it's the same thing with the Palestinians. They were the local Arabs. They became the Palestinians in the 60s. This flag was taken up by them, and the PLO became, instead of the Palestine Liberation Organization to free this area, it became the Palestinian Liberation Organization, this tiny people that are supposedly the indigenous people of the land who are fighting against the massive Israeli war machine. But it's all mythology and propaganda.
You know, just listening to you, I think about the question, you know, I often talk about how dangerous it is to be biblically illiterate, but it seems to me that it is equally dangerous, or certainly very dangerous, to be historically illiterate. And I think even our politicians are historically illiterate. For example, Yasser Arafat, was he really born as a Palestinian?
He was an Egyptian, and he became a Palestinian later on. A lot of the Palestinians, as a matter of fact, come from somewhere else, because one of the things that happened was the area of the Holy Land, or of Palestine, was almost uninhabited. It was desolate and empty in the 19th century. Many English-speaking travelers actually went through there. And in the book, The Palestinian Delusion, I quote a lot of them, and they talk about going for miles and not seeing another human being and so on. Mark Twain went there. He's one of them. He's the most famous who spoke about the desolation of this land. And so what happened was the Zionist movement became the impetus for a lot of Jews to move back to this area. There were Jews who were already there. The Jews who always were there are called the Yeshuv in the Jewish community, and they were always in the area of Palestine, or what is now Israel, from time immemorial. They never left. They didn't leave when the Romans expelled them. They didn't leave when the Arabs came in. They always stayed. But others started to come in the 19th century, and what happened was this became the impetus for a lot of Arabs to move to Palestine, because they realized in the first place, the Jews are moving there. They're going to open businesses. They're going to need employees. This is going to be a place where I can earn some real money. And so it's interesting to note that a lot of the people who are calling themselves Palestinians today only moved to Palestine in the first place because of Zionism. They weren't always there. And they didn't move there in spite of Zionism. They moved there because of Zionism. Also, the Ottomans, who ruled the territory in the 19th century, they were alarmed by Zionism because they were Muslims. And they believed that this land was Islamic. They didn't want to see it become a Jewish territory as it did. And so they also started to forcibly move people into the area who were from elsewhere. And so even to this day, you have a lot of surnames among the Palestinians, like Al-Kurdi, that's the Kurd, you know, and names of that kind that show these people are from somewhere else. They're not really indigenous at all. And Arafat was one of them.
Yeah. So one of the things that I found intriguing about reading your book is the history of the peace process, or so-called peace process. And I wonder if you can give us some kind of an overview of that, starting with the Camp David Accords back in, I think, 1978.
Yeah, you know, that was, as far as I was concerned, doing the research on that book, that was the wildest stuff to discover. I hadn't realized all these things about, for example, Anwar Sadat. Anwar Sadat is revered today as a hero all over the world.
And a martyr.
A martyr for peace, no
yeah,
less.
Yeah.
You know, somebody who gave his life for trying to bring about peace between Egypt and Israel and peace in the world. he's right up there with all the secular saints of our modern age, you know, Gandhi and Martin Luther King and RFK, you know, all the people that a seventh grade social studies
class. You mean
class
JFK?
Both of them, but whatever, sure.
Yeah, I guess both of them.
But yeah, JFK first, certainly, yeah. And anyway, the whole idea, what I mean is that these people are the heroes of the civic religion that we live under, and the general outlook of the world is that this was a great man. I remember actually I was in Jerusalem and I was surprised to see, I should have not been surprised, but I was surprised to see the Sadat Begin Center in Jerusalem. That's this big center to try to bring about peace. And they revere Sadat along with Menachem Begin, who was the Israeli prime minister at Camp David, as great peacemakers. Now, the reality is quite different, as I show in the book. Sadat actually was a Soviet client to start with. And the story of the Middle East peace process really begins with his failure to destroy Israel in the 1973 Yom Kippur War. He invaded Israel on Yom Kippur, and it looked as if the Israelis had been caught off guard. They were caught off guard, and it looked as if they could lose and the country would be destroyed, because of course it's a very tiny country. And miraculously, against all odds, they were able to beat the Egyptians and all the others, the Syrians and all the rest, back and win another improbable victory only 6 years after the Six Day War. And Sadat was furious and appalled. And we know this because of the minutes of a Politburo meeting in Moscow. And Leonid Brezhnev is saying that Sadat is calling me in the middle of the night and pleading and saying, you have to send us better weapons. You have to send us Soviet troops. And he said, they already have the best weapons. We sent them better weapons than we're sending to the Vietnamese. And we're not going to send troops there. If he can't win with what he's got, then forget about him. And Gromyko, the foreign ministry, says, well, what are you going to do? And he said, I'm going to make peace with Israel. And he can get in line or he can go his own way, but I don't care. I've had enough of him. Now, this is, you never hear this. You never hear about Sadat wanting to destroy Israel and he can't and he's failed and he goes pleading to Brezhnev. But this is straight from the Soviet archives. It's all in there. And it only came out much later, you know, when Sadat was dead, Brezhnev was dead, the Soviet Union had fallen, the whole thing was over, it was history. But what happened was Sadat was not a dumb guy. He was very, very brilliant. And so when he saw that the Soviets were not going to back him, he realized that the best way he could get what he wanted was not via war, but via diplomacy. And that the best way to pursue the diplomacy was not to be a Soviet client against Israel, but to switch sides in the height of the Cold War, ally with the United States, and then get the United States in gratitude to pressure Israel to give Egypt what it wanted. And it was a brilliant idea. It worked perfectly. Sadat announced that he was going to go visit Jerusalem. The whole world was thrilled and delighted that he was going to be so generous and so far-seeing and so courageous as to visit the capital. Well, in those days, it wasn't recognized as the capital, but to visit the major city of the country that he had so recently tried to destroy. And he went there and he reached out in friendship. And it was all because Israel was occupying Sinai that it had occupied after the Six-Day War in 1967. And he wanted to get Sinai back. That was what it was all about. And he tried to get it back by invading Israel again. He lost again. And so he was going to go about it this way. So Jimmy Carter becomes president in January 1977. And he wants a big foreign policy achievement to cement his legacy as a great president. So he calls for Sadat and Begin to come to Camp David and talk it all out with just the three of them, because Jimmy Carter had a supreme confidence in his own abilities to solve any conflict really, and to help people see that they had common interests and to see eye to eye where they had previously disagreed. The problem with Carter was that he was extraordinarily naive, and he was enthralled with Sadat, but he also had contempt for Begin. He despised Begin and he disliked Israel. So Begin sent people over to try to teach Jimmy Carter about the history of the region, about the fact, for example, that there were no Palestinians, that these were the local Arabs, that the countries surrounding Israel had refused to give them citizenship, even though they were no different from the citizens of those countries, ethnically, linguistically, or culturally, or religiously, as I explained before. They wouldn't give them citizenship because they wanted to keep them as refugees so they could use them as weapons against Israel. Try to explain all that to Carter. Carter got impatient, got angry, waved them away. And at Camp David, he told Sadat that I'm with you, I will get everything you want out of Begin. And he was borderline hostile to Begin. He was very friendly to Sadat. It was kind of an overloaded two against one situation. Begin was trying to ingratiate himself, trying to be treated with mutual respect by these men. And so he was willing to make concessions, but there were no concessions on the other side forthcoming. And he ended up giving back the Sinai for a bunch of promises that have not been kept. The Egyptians have not invaded Israel since the 70s. That is true. That they have kept, but they've been paid by the Americans every year. But they have not done anything to stop the spread of anti-Jewish and anti-Israel propaganda in Egypt, where even Mein Kampf of Adolf Hitler is a bestseller every year and so on. And they haven't done a thing to stop all that, which is contrary to the Camp David Accords. But in any case, Sadat got the Sinai back. He got everything he wanted for just a few platitudes and promises. They all went down in history as peacemakers. They won the Nobel Prize. Everybody lives happily ever after, but it's not the way people think.
You know, I want to get back to this whole idea of the peace process in just a moment, but there's another phrase that I caught in your book, and it's not out of the blue by any stretch of the imagination, but I do want you to elaborate on this phrase a little bit. It's the phrase, the right of conquest. What does that entail?
In history, there has always been recognized that if you are in a war that you did not start, if you are attacked by an aggressor nation and you win the war and defeat the aggressor nation, then you have a perfect right to seize territory from the aggressor nation and hold it by the right of conquest so that you can minimize the threat from the aggressor nation in the future. So take, for example, World War II. If you look at the maps of Europe before World War II and after World War II, they're quite different. And Germany is much smaller after World War II. Why? Because the Soviet Union took territory, Poland took territory, Denmark, France, although those territories were disputed a little bit longer, and Germany ended up substantially diminished. Germany did not contest this and was not in a position to do so because it was the aggressor nation. It had started the war, and it was a universally recognized rule of warfare that an aggressor nation that loses a war that it started, particularly one that has no conceivable justification, has no right to object if its territory is reduced. The only time this has not been respected as a rule of warfare is when Israel took territories after the Six-Day War. Now, the territories that it took were called the West Bank and Gaza. If you look in the Bible, there are innumerable mentions of Gaza, and it is Jewish territory. It's not the territory of the Philistines, much less the Palestinians, who are never mentioned in the Bible. And I'm talking about just the Bible as a historical record, even if you're not a believer. The fact is that it's very clear that Gaza is part of the territory of the Jews. The West Bank, what is that? It's the West Bank of the River Jordan. The West Bank of the River Jordan. The River Jordan has been there, I guess, since the creation of the world. But the West Bank was never called this until 1950. What was it called before 1950? Judea. Judea and Samaria. What does Judea mean, the land of the Jews? The Jordanians, who had occupied that territory during the 1948 war to destroy Israel, they renamed it the West Bank precisely in order to loosen and weaken the obvious connection of the Jews to that land, the historical connection. So what happened was the land of Gaza and the land of the West Bank, or Judea and Samaria, were part of the original mandate for Palestine that had been set aside by the League of Nations in 1920 for a Jewish national home. And so that was supposed to be part of the land of Israel. But during the 1948 war, in which the Arab states surrounding Israel tried to destroy it, solely because it existed and was a Jewish state, they were totally the aggressors. At the end of the war in 1949, or when an armistice was signed, Jordan was occupying Judea and Samaria, and Egypt was occupying Gaza. So that occupation continued for 19 years. It's also worth noting, Hank, that during those 19 years, nobody in Gaza and nobody in Judea and Samaria or the West Bank ever complained about occupation. They complain about occupation all the time now. But what they really don't like is that it's the Jews. When it was Muslim Arabs who were occupying the territory, they had no problem with it. And you never heard a peep about occupation. But anyway, the Israelis recaptured those territories in 1967. And they are considered the occupied territories. Those are essential to Israeli security. Maybe not Gaza, but certainly the West Bank or Judea and Samaria. Because if you don't have Judea and Samaria, or at least part of it, then Israel is 9 miles wide at its weakest point. So you just have a bad day on the battlefield, you cut the nation in half, and the whole thing could be destroyed. So as a matter of its own security, Israel has a claim to the West Bank. As a matter of the laws of nations, the rules of warfare from time immemorial, Israel has a claim to the West Bank. And yet it's still always called occupied territory. Well, whose territory actually is it occupying? It never belonged to Jordan. And there was never a Palestinian state. The Ottoman Empire, which was the last country to own it, no longer exists and actually ceded the territory. So you can't say it belongs to the Turkish Republic, because the Ottomans, in one of their last acts, ceded the territory to the League of Nations, which then set it aside for the Jewish national home. So whose land are they occupying? It's their land.
You know, this may be somewhat out of left field. I don't know if it will be for you or not, but probably not, because you're so well read. But I think of Christian Zionism, which predates secular Zionism, and the Zionists that are popular today. One of the prominent Zionists, you see him on television all the time with his ads, John Hagee. He's also a prosperity preacher. This is what he says. And the prologue to this is, he is convinced that Israel will soon control not only the West Bank, Gaza, and Golan, but Iraq, Jordan, and Lebanon. And I'll read a direct quote from him. He says, "The royal land grant that God, the original owner, gave to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their seed forever, includes the following territory, which is presently occupied by Israel, and that is the West Bank, all of Lebanon, one half of Syria, two-thirds of Jordan, all of Iraq, and the cream of the crop northern portion of Saudi Arabia." Now, basically what they're saying is that Israel, according to God, should have a landmass 30 times its present size. And if God does not give Israel that land, then God is going to be proved to be a liar. because he promised that land to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but that promise was never realized. And for God to be true, this is the argument. It's not a true argument, obviously. It's not an authentic biblical argument because the land was actually part of the Solomonic kingdom. But apart from that, the dispensationalists, the Christian Zionists are saying unless Israel gets that amount of land, 30 times its present size, God's going to be proved a liar. God won't be proved a liar. So this has to happen in the end times, probably before the rapture. All that land has to go to Israel. So you have the Christian Zionists really fomenting a lot of problems in the Middle East there as well with their particular unbiblical prescription of Zionism. And then I would argue, too, you have people that are in the Israeli government that are using that very language saying, yeah, that's the biblical deed to the land. And, you know, I'm just saying that for some looking at this, they're saying this is a great opportunity for an Israeli land grab, sanctioned by Christians and sanctioned by the Bible.
Well, in the first place, in terms of the Israeli government, there may be some people who are saying that that should be done. But that's not the policy of the Israeli state, and I would be extraordinarily surprised. I would be surprised beyond belief, really. I would be shocked more than I've ever been shocked in my life were Israel to pursue that as a vision and a foreign policy, because I don't think that they have the resources, they don't have the personnel, it's just not a big enough population to be able to subdue and hold all those territories. But quite aside from that, this is a religious vision, and I don't believe it's a correct one, as you noted. But I think it would be foolish in the extreme if the Israelis or anyone else were to be getting the Israeli foreign policy or the Israeli goals for the next few years out of scripture. That's not what scripture is ultimately for. It's not a policy manual for political action. We're not Muslims. Islam is a political religion. And the Lord said, render unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's and to God the things that are God, which I think is a reflection of a legitimate distinction between the political realm and the religious. And you'll notice that while I am a Christian, an Orthodox Christian, at the same time, I don't base anything that I defend Israel upon on scripture or on Christian teachings. I do not believe that because Israel is written about in the Bible or because the Bible says various things about it, that therefore the Jews today have a right to the land and others must be displaced or something of that kind. I believe that Israel has a right to that territory on historical grounds and on the grounds of the political situation that I was just outlining to you, that that land doesn't belong to anybody but to the state of Israel. That it was essentially uninhabited. It was sparsely inhabited at a time when there was tremendous Jewish settlement. The people who owned the land set it aside for Jewish settlement in recognition of their historical connection to the land. And there are 22 Arab states right next door that could easily have absorbed the refugee population should there have been people who, I don't believe also in the propaganda about the Israelis driving the Arabs out, because there is too much evidence, and I've got it in the book, you probably saw it, there's abundant evidence that the Arabs themselves, the Arab Higher Committee and others, told the Arabs to leave when the state of Israel was founded, because they thought that the Arab states were going to destroy Israel, and they wanted the Arabs out of the line of fire, and then they'd be able to come back. Didn't work out that way. They lost the war. But the point is that they did not get driven out. They fled of their own accord. And they could have settled in any of these countries that were completely compatible, simpatico with them on a cultural, linguistic, and religious level. And they didn't, because those countries wanted to keep use them, manipulate them, and use them as tools and as weapons against the Israeli state. So this is a historical case and a legal case. It is not a religious case. I'm not saying there can't be a religious case that can be made, but I think it's very dangerous what Pastor Hagee is doing if he's saying that this is some inevitability or some responsibility that the Israelis have to make war against these surrounding states, because it only fuels the jihad propaganda, which is often cast in a defensive mode. You see, Hank, only the caliph, the successor of Muhammad, as political, military, and spiritual leader of the Muslims, only the caliph can declare offensive jihad. I spoke about offensive jihad way back at the beginning of the show, but only the caliph can declare offensive jihad by law, according to the Sunni Islamic law. So there's no caliph. There's been no caliph since 1924. So nobody can declare offensive jihad, which means not that there's no jihad. Every jihad today has to be defensive, which means it has to be based on grievances. If you read Osama bin Laden's declaration of jihad against the United States in the late 1990s, he lists all these grievances, all these terrible things the Americans have supposedly done. And those justify his jihad against America. He has to cast it as defensive, because otherwise it's got no justification according to Islamic theology. So when people in the Israeli government or John Hagee or anybody else starts saying, well, you know, Israel has a divine right to Iraq and northern Saudi Arabia and all these other territories that you mentioned, that just, it goes right on the grievance list for the jihadis. And they say, you see, the Israelis, they want to destroy Iraq. They want to make war against all these Islamic lands. So we have to defend ourselves. And it just incites more jihad violence. So it's extremely irresponsible as far as I'm concerned.
I want to move on to some detail that you provide in the book, and you are very articulate in communicating this verbally as well, is some detail about the PLO, Hamas, the Muslim Brotherhood. Give us some kind of a sense, because for the average American, you hear those monikers, but oftentimes you don't really understand what they represent or how they're interconnected.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the PLO I was talking about before, so I'll start with them because they're the oldest. Actually, the Muslim Brotherhood is the oldest group, but I'll get to them in a minute. The PLO started in the 1950s, I believe, and it was the Palestine Liberation Organization, a secular group that was actually aligned with the Soviets, just as Anwar Sadat was aligned with the Soviets, because the Israelis were aligned with the United States. And in those days, this is the height of the Cold War and the binary of the Cold War, that you're either with us or with them. You're either on the Soviet side or on the American side. So the Israelis are on the American side, the Arabs are on the Soviet side. So the Palestine Liberation Organization started out as a secular, even Marxist organization dedicated to the destruction of Israel. And it made it very clear in its charter that it was not interested in diminishing Israel, in establishing a Palestinian state that would live side by side with Israel, you know, no two-state solution and all that. It was wanting to destroy Israel altogether. Renamed, as I explained before, the Palestinian Liberation Organization in 1964, when the Palestinians were invented. And it became progressively more Islamic as time went on, so that nowadays, you've got Mahmoud Abbas, who's the successor of Yasser Arafat as the head of the PLO, and he, of course, is president of the Palestinian Authority. He speaks much more in terms of Islam and in terms of the right of the Islamic nation to this land than he does about the oppressed people, the Palestinians, throwing off the yoke of the oppressor, the Israelis. The rhetoric has shifted markedly in an Islamic direction, just as the whole Islamic world has become much less secular over the last century and much more religious. So that's one group. That's the lead group, actually, that controls the Palestinian Authority. And it is the oldest, most venerable group among the Palestinian so-called liberation organizations, and the one really from which all the others come to some degree, or to which they all are related in some degree. You know, some guy was originally in the PLO, and then he decides that he wants to be more radical and so on. The PLO are what I call slow jihadis. there's the slow jihad and the fast jihad. There are all kinds of different jihads, but this is one distinction that my colleague at Jihad Watch, Hugh Fitzgerald, has formulated, and I think it's very useful. The PLO is willing to negotiate with Israel. And so you see the Palestinian Authority made the Oslo Accords in the 90s and the roadmap to peace with George W. Bush in the 2000s, and they're willing to talk. But their goal is ultimately the same as that of the fast jihadis like Hamas. They want to destroy Israel altogether. Hamas was founded in the late 1980s, in 87, I believe it was, 87 or 88. And they also want to destroy Israel, but they were, from the beginning, a markedly Islamic group. As a matter of fact, there is an epigraph on the Hamas charter that says, Israel will arise and remain until Islam obliterates it. So Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas is an acronym for Islamic Resistance Movement in Arabic. It is dedicated to the destruction of Israel on Islamic grounds, that it is explicitly all about restoring what they see as the Islamic right to this land. Now, the PLO is really based on that also, ultimately, but as I said, they couched it in Marxist rhetoric at the beginning because they wanted the Soviet help. Now, the Hamas group says that it is part of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's the Muslim Brotherhood for Gaza. The Muslim Brotherhood was founded in Egypt in 1928. The caliphate, I said there was no caliph, and you have to have a caliph to declare offensive war. There were always caliphs in the Islamic world until 1924, when the secular Turkish government abolished the Ottoman caliphate. The empire was already gone, but the caliph had remained as the nominal leader of the Islamic world and successor of Muhammad. But the caliphate was abolished in 1924. As a direct reaction to that, Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, started the Brotherhood in 1928 for the express purpose of reuniting the Islamic world, restoring the caliphate, and then resuming the jihad against the non-Muslim world. So Hamas says that it is the Muslim Brotherhood for Palestine, and it is dedicated to exactly that, destroying Israel, restoring Islamic rule in the region in service of the ultimate restoration of the caliphate. So you have Hamas criticizing the PLO, both on Islamic grounds, that the PLO is not Islamic enough, but also on tactical grounds, that Hamas wants to go into Israel and do what it did on October 7th. They would do October 7th every day if they could, and just kill Israelis wholesale. The PLO is willing to sit down and talk. Hamas does not want to sit down and talk. They lately have been talking about truces, but that's also something that's allowed in Islam, because Islamic law stipulates if you're fighting an infidel and the infidel's winning, ask for a truce, gather your strength, fight again more effectively. That's what a truce is for. It's if you're losing, it's so that you can strengthen yourself and start to win again. So that's why Hamas calls for a ceasefire. But ultimately, it's not interested in talking, just wants to destroy Israel, and would do it if it could right away.
So it's always just a lull in the storm.
Yeah, a lull in the storm is exactly it. That's what you'd get. If there were a ceasefire today between Israel and Hamas, Hamas would start fighting again as soon as it could. And, you know, you had a Hamas official, I think it was Hamad, who said right after October 7th, it might have been on October 8th, if I recall correctly, that we're going to have another October 7th, we're going to have October 100th, we're going to have October 1 millionth, we're going to just keep coming and carrying out massacres on that scale as long as it takes until Israel is completely destroyed.
You have a subheading in your book, I'll read it, Barack Hussein, Obama versus Israel. And in that piece, you talk about, and I also do in my book, Muslim, but some of the very anti-Semitic positions that have been taken by presidents of the United States, and most notably, some of the quotes by Barack Obama, which have been chilling, quite frankly.
Yeah. Well, Obama really was the first president to drive a wedge between the U.S. and Israel. Israel and the U.S. had always had a very close relationship. As a matter of fact, the Democratic Party platform, up until 2008, when Obama was first nominated, spoke about a special relationship between the U.S. and Israel. Harry Truman recognized the independence of Israel just like about 15 minutes after Israel declared independence. He was ready and waiting. And there was always a closeness, a kinship between the two countries that was actually reinforced on 9/11 when the same jihadis, a lot of people don't recognize, but the same jihadis of the same ideology as Hamas and the Palestinian Liberation Organization hit New York and Washington. And so we're facing the same jihadist foe who wants to destroy both America and Israel. But Obama changed all that. And for the first time, the United States government became openly critical of Israel, became actually abstained on a vote at the UN. The Biden team did that recently, but they weren't the first to do it. Obama, in his waning days, I believe that Trump had already been elected president, but it was before the inauguration, if I recall correctly, and the Obama administration abstained on a motion at the UN condemning Israel. Now, this was a major thing because the way the UN works, the Security Council, the permanent members of the Security Council, the US, the Soviet Union, and then Russia, China, the UK, I think there might be one other, France maybe? Anyway, they have veto power that they can exercise so that something doesn't pass if they vote against it. So the UN could vote 180-1 for something, but if the one is the United States, then it loses. It doesn't pass because the United States, like these other Security Council permanent members, has veto power. So if the US had voted no, Israel would not have been condemned. But the US abstained, allowing for the condemnation of Israel. That had never happened before. Barack Obama was the first president to allow that, and Biden was the second. Then there were many indignities that he subjected Netanyahu to. As a matter of fact, I have a news website, Jihad Watch, that I operate every day, posting news and commentary about jihad activity. And of course, like all news sites, we have a stock of photos that we use. And one photo that I used to use quite often during the Obama administration when there was news about the U.S. and Israel was this photo of Obama and Netanyahu together. But Obama is looking at Netanyahu with absolutely frightening, unconcealed hostility that you never see at that level. You know, usually when you see heads of state or a head of state and a head of government talking, they're all smiles, no matter what goes on behind closed doors. But Obama's just scowling at Netanyahu. And I thought this is a revealing and indicative picture of the real what he really thinks about Israel. And so I used it a lot. And there were plenty of occasions to use it because the U.S. formulated all kinds of policies. Like, for example, the whole hostility to the settlements. Israel is always in trouble with the UN and now with the U.S. State Department for building or allowing Israeli citizens to build houses in the West Bank. Now, the West Bank was divided up by the Oslo Accords in the 90s, and there actually is an area of it that is open to settlement by the Israelis, but this is always ignored. And anytime the Israelis actually build there, it becomes the focus of international condemnation. And it's said that they are building on occupied territory, which, as I explained before, is not even true to start with. But it was the Obama administration started all that. Nobody was complaining about Israeli settlements before that. Now they're this big flashpoint that Israel has to stop building settlements or there can be no peace process. And the whole thing is this one false assumption based on another and building this giant house of cards.
Why did he go so soft on Iran?
It seems as if Obama had bought a foreign policy analysis that saw Iran as replacing Iraq as the source of stability in the region. Now, of course, the United States was responsible for Iraq no longer being a source of stability in the region by removing Saddam Hussein. Now, Saddam Hussein was not a good guy, and he was certainly a violent and repressive ruler. But you know, Hank, the world is not perfect and sin is everywhere. Sometimes you have to make hard choices. The United States made the hard choice to remove Saddam Hussein, and it was like lifting up a rock. And if you just left the rock alone, then the rock actually served a purpose. And who knows what? I don't want to strain the analogy over much, but you lift up the rock and there are all these maggots and things that start coming out, and it would have been better if you just left them there. After Saddam Hussein was toppled, the ISIS group grew up as an opposing force of Sunnis to the weak Shiite government that we installed in Baghdad. And all manner of ills followed from that. The Christians were violently persecuted, and most of them left the country. The Yazidis were violently persecuted, killed in massive numbers. It was just a terrible thing altogether, and it didn't have to happen if Saddam Hussein had been left there. But once he was gone and Iraq was destabilized, a lot of State Department wonks thought this is the time where we'll empower Iran, and Iran will be the stabilizing force in the region. And Iran was, of course, delighted because they're Shiites. And most of the Islamic world is Sunni. The Shiites are only about 15%, but the Iranians have long had designs on creating a situation in which they control a large swath of the Middle East, and they actually are the leaders of the Islamic world, even though they're this minority sect. So they already had a client state in Assad, Syria, because Assad's an Alawite. The Alawites are only 12% of the population of Syria, but they're a Shiite offshoot, and they get their legitimacy from the Islamic Republic of Iran. The Iranian mullahs certified them as real Muslims, and so they have a legitimacy from that that's enabled them to stay in power, but this made Syria an Iranian client. Then they filled Lebanon with Shiites and created Hezbollah, and that has now made Lebanon essentially a client state of Iran and a very dangerous rogue state that's ruled by this terror group. And they had designs on Jordan and certainly Iraq, which had a Shiite majority, wanting to establish this Shiite crescent all the way across the Middle East and then move down south from Lebanon and destroy Israel. They also fund Hamas so they can move up from both sides and destroy Israel. And so the Obama administration thought, hey, this is great. We'll help them do this, and it'll stabilize the whole region, when, of course, it's done just the opposite.
Yeah, I want to start to sort of sum up this podcast, but there are a number of very pertinent questions, I think, that are still on the table. The first of which is, from your perspective, why such a growing number of people, a cascading number of people from all around the world who seem to believe that Palestinian terrorism against Israel is actually justified? And what's the catalyst to all of that?
Well, I think the seeds of it have been planted decades ago, that you have to go back to the long march through the institutions that started in the 1960s. That is the hard left's decision that instead of holding sit-ins and protests on campuses, they would actually take over the campuses. They would take over the colleges and universities, and they've done it. They've been extraordinarily successful, so that the great majority, I should say, of colleges and universities in the United States today are staffed by professors who are Marxists. And the Marxists see the world in terms of the oppressor and the oppressed. And they see the world that in the Middle East, that the Israelis are the oppressors and the Palestinians are the oppressed. Moreover, you add the whole racism narrative on top of that. The Israelis are white oppressors and the Palestinians are brown oppressed. This is a lot of nonsense, but this is the mythology of our age. And so they buy this. They've taught this to a generation of students. They control all these universities that are getting millions of dollars from Qatar to teach exactly this kind of thing. And so you have all these people who are miseducated, half-educated, propagandized and indoctrinated, and they think Israel is this usurper of Europeans who came down and stole a land that was indigenously the Palestinians' land. It's not a historical fact, but they don't know the historical facts. They know what they've been taught in their universities, which is not true. But this is the state of the world today.
Wow. Is there a solution?
Well, sure. You and I are being part of it right now by having this conversation. And I thank you for having such an in-depth conversation about these issues and having the courage to do it. Because in the first place, I know I've been alarmed, as a matter of fact, Hank, since October 7th, by the rise of anti-Semitism among Christians and a sort of irrational, I think, opposition to Israel among Christians. I mean, Orthodox Christians, Catholic Christians, and Protestant Christians. And I've been shocked to see the recrudescence of ancient anti-Semitic myths over the last few months, to the degree that I actually wrote a book about anti-Semitism that will be coming out early next year. So I applaud you for having this conversation to start with. And I think the only thing we can do is just tell the truth and trust in the Lord that the truth will prevail over falsehood. The falsehood, however, has all the megaphones and all the money. And so the only thing we can do is just stand and keep telling the truth and trust in the fact that truth is reality. Truth is just what corresponds to what is real. And so insofar as what we're saying is true, it will ultimately prevail, because it's going to be impossible to sustain the war against reality that so much of the world is pursuing these days. The evidence of their senses will continue to show them. You know, they might think the Palestinians are the noble people who are fighting a defensive war against Israeli oppression, but the more October 7s that they do carry out, the more they call for genocide of the Jews, the more that they are open about their bloodlust and their genocidal imperatives, the more people will wake up to reality.
You actually don't think that there is a real solution to the Middle East crisis. You think that crisis can only be managed. Am I correctly communicating your view?
100%. Yeah. Americans want solutions. You know, I think especially nowadays, people, the vast majority of people grew up watching television and they're used to all the problems being solved in a half hour or an hour. And so they think there ought to be a solution. There's got to be a way to figure this out, and we'll go to a commercial. There is no way to solve this, because as long as there are people who believe in Allah and Muhammad and the Quran, there will be people who think they have to wage jihad against Israel and against the United States, for that matter. And so the only thing to do is to go by Islamic law in that regard, which says you do not fight jihad against an enemy that has more than twice your strength, and you have no chance of winning. And so if we presented that kind of strength to them, they wouldn't fight. And that was the situation that actually prevailed throughout much of the 1950s and up to the 1967 war. Not entirely, but it did to a tremendous degree. And certainly even before the founding of the State of Israel, that was the situation in a great part of the Islamic world, that it was not strong, could not pursue jihad, and didn't.
I want to read something that you close your book with. I don't think it's the last paragraph, but it's close to the last paragraph, and have you comment. You write, "It is time for a new approach. The response of Israel, and that of the free world in general, should not be fear or hatred, but a sober realism, a determination to remain resolute against the jihad, to defend Israel as a legitimate state, as a free society, and then to stand firm for humane values as well as the principles of human rights."
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think that's basically what we have to do right there. That's the only thing we can do.
Well said.
It's just a massive injustice. You know, I'm not Jewish, I'm not Israeli, but this is a massive injustice that's being perpetrated against people who are human beings, who are creations of God. This is just a matter of standing for what is right, to stand on the side of Israel.
You're a man that I admire for a lot of reasons. You do first-rate primary research, for one thing. So I have read your books, I have followed your organization for a long period of time, and I always find that you come down on the right side of the facts. You do your homework. And I suppose this is probably why you were in such demand by government agencies. My question to you right now is, while you have led seminars on Islam and jihad for the FBI, for the United States Central Command, for the United States Army Command, etc., the whole list that I went through at the beginning of the podcast, are you still welcome in those circles?
Oh, no. Oh, no. It doesn't look good in a bio, so I don't have it in there. But I've never made a secret of it. I was fired in 2011, October 19th, 2011, actually. 57 Muslim and South Asian organizations wrote an open letter to John Brennan, who at that time was in the Department of Homeland Security, and later he became head of the CIA. And they actually demanded that I be fired by name. I was kind of flattered on the one side that that heard of me, you know, but seriously, they said that I was teaching this Islamophobic material and had to be removed. And they demanded that all mention of Islam and jihad be removed from all counterterror training materials. And Brennan immediately wrote back. Not only did he write back, he wrote back on White House stationery, which I've always thought was significant because, you know, everybody in Washington, every petty office holder has his own stationery. Brennan certainly did. But he wrote back on Barack Obama's stationery as if to signal this is coming from the very top. This is not just me talking. It's also Barack. And what Brennan said was, yes, we'll fire Spencer right away and we'll remove all mention of Islam and jihad from counterterror training. And at that time, the Obama administration formulated its counterterror strategy, which was called CVE, Countering Violent Extremism, CVE. And they never mentioned Islam or jihad in any way. Ever since then, that's been the policy of the U.S. government. It still does not acknowledge that there is any Islamic jihad. So no, I'm not welcome in those circles and have not been for many years. But I believe that that is part of an abdication of responsibility on the part of the U.S. government and its willful denial of a genuine threat. Even more insidiously, during the Biden administration, we saw the term violent extremists being applied to people who were simply critics of the administration. And I thought, oh, now the other shoe is dropping. Not only did they stop talking about Islamic jihadis, but now they're going to use this violent extremist language against just people they don't like and want to silence. And I myself was put on a violent extremist list by the Global Internet Forum for Counterterrorism, which is the social media giant's counter-terror arm. And I protested to them, and they refused to take me off, even though it's ludicrous because I've never called for any violence. But this is where things are tending now, that they're going to weaponize these vague terms against people who are saying things they don't want said.
Well, Robert Spencer, I knew all of that. And yet I asked you to write the foreword to my book, Muslim. And I got to tell you, I've never said this to you publicly. I have said it to you privately, but I'm deeply grateful that you did because I respect you very much.
Well, likewise, and thank you. The honor was all mine.
And thank you so much for the time you've given us on this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. You certainly live up to our mission statement. You're interesting, you're informative, and you are inspirational. I appreciate people that know history, that do primary research, and that are true to their convictions, meaning you're not one that is going to ever be worried about the term politically correct. Robert Spencer is politically correct. You're going to be correct on the facts. And again, I appreciate people like you more and more every day.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that very much. And like I said, you know, it's so rare to have somebody willing to talk about these things on a large forum, and so rare that when you do, that we can have this kind of in-depth discussion instead of trying to cover all this territory in 15 minutes or whatever. And so I'm very grateful to you and thank you.
Well, the book, The Palestinian Delusion, I enjoyed reading it. My staff has enjoyed reading it. The subtitle, by the way, is The Catastrophic History of the Middle East Peace Process. The author, again, Robert Spencer, he's my guest, he's my friend. And I'm looking forward to your next book, so we'll have to do a podcast on that as well. What's the title of your upcoming book?
Yeah, it's called Muhammad, A Critical Biography. It'll be out in just a few weeks. I just got copies. It's a biography of Muhammad, but it's a little different. It's an investigation of the historical reliability of these various stories. And when you go into Islamic tradition, you'll find that it's full of contradictions. It's not what you'd expect from historically accurate records. For example, we think we're talking about a guy named Muhammad, but there are early Islamic traditions that say, well, his name was actually Qutam, and it changed to Muhammad later. And we think that he got visions, or said he did, from the angel Gabriel, who gave him the Quran. And there are early Islamic traditions say it was the angel Sarafel, and later on Gabriel replaced him. And this is all indication that these were stories, maybe of other people, that were amalgamated into the Muhammad story, competing stories sometimes with contradictory elements between one version and the other. And so, what it amounts to is, I don't know how anybody could read this book and come away thinking Muhammad was a historical figure. This is the myths and legends.
Can't wait to read that book. And I want to thank everybody for tuning in to this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Again, our mission statement is to have people who are interesting, informative, and inspirational. If you enjoyed the podcast, subscribe, rate, review. It helps a lot. And I want to thank everybody once again for your comments, for your encouragement, and for your participation in a podcast that is willing to tell the truth, no matter what the cost. Thanks for tuning in. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of the Hank Unplugged podcast. So long for now.